content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 13th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obama makes his move on climate change. The Obama administration took a historic step in the fight against climate change this week, unveiling rules to curb carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. The proposed new standards, to be enforced through the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, would seek to cut power plant emissions by 30% from 2005 levels by 2030. Each state will be given a target based on its current emissions, but will also be able to draw up its own plan for hitting that target. Possible approaches include renovating existing coal-fired plants with technology that scrubs carbon from emissions, converting the plants to use natural gas, and forming a cap-and-trade network in which companies receive emissions allowances that they can buy or sell depending on their needs. Congressional Republicans blocked legislation in 2010 that would have set up a similar system, but President Obama bypassed Congress this time on the basis of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that gave the EPA the authority to regulate carbon dioxide levels. "The science is clear," said EPA Chief Gina McCarthy. "The time to act is now." Republicans in Congress immediately vowed to try to block the new rules, claiming they would raise energy prices and cripple America's coal-producing regions. The issue is likely to play a role in November's midterm elections, especially in coal-producing states. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is fighting to retain his seat in the coal state of Kentucky, called the legislation a dagger in the heart of the American middle class. What the editorial said: "These regulations mark the nation's first truly serious assault on climate change," said the Boston Globe. "Coal-fired power plants are America's largest sources of carbon dioxide, yet until now they've never faced a single restriction on emissions. Obama's realistic goal will spur investment in cleaner technology and reduce emissions equivalent to taking nearly two-thirds of the nation's passenger vehicles off the road. Most importantly, it will also give the USA the credibility to push other countries, including fast-growing, fast-polluting China, to enact similar measures." "Consumers will pay for this presidential overreach," said the Wall Street Journal. "It is almost impossible to raise the price of carbon energy without also raising costs across the economy. And those increases, along with energy price rises, will be passed down to everyone, including the poor." The irony is that this legislation will make no tangible difference in global warming. The EPA has admitted that even if we shut down every coal-fired power plant in the country, it would reduce Earth's temperature by just 1/20th of a degree Fahrenheit in 100 years. What the columnist said: "Liberals are celebrating, but this plan won't save a single cute polar bear," said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "It will cause huge job losses and could cost the Democrats control of the Senate. So why is Obama so desperate to push it through? He famously promised in 2008 that his election would signal the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and the planet began to heal. With his popularity sinking, Obama wants to reestablish himself as the Prince of Hope and Change." "Here's a less cynical possibility," said Bill Scher in RealClearPolitics.com. "Maybe the fate of the planet is more important to him than holding on to the Senate. Obama knew that if he waited until after November, legal challenges and other hurdles might prevent the rules from going into effect before he left office. And despite what conservatives say, this legislation really could make a difference, said Brandon Keim in Wired.com. One cap-and-trade program involving nine northeastern states has seen power plant pollution drop by 40% since 2005. Emissions have actually been falling across the U.S. for years, said Brian Walsh in Time.com. The cheap natural gas produced by the fracking revolution and other new energy technology has enabled the country to move away from dirty coal, and it'll continue to do so. America will almost certainly be greener by 2030, but for reasons that go far beyond a 626-page regulatory order coming out of Washington. And it wasn't all bad. A California man with nothing to his name faced the dilemma of a lifetime when he found a bag filled with $125,000. Joe Cornell, 52, was watering trees across from the rehab center where he stays for drug addiction when a passing car honked at an armored truck. Nearby, he found the bag. "I started crying and shaking," he said. "Everything was going through my head. The good devil, bad devil thing." To set an example for his grandkids, he notified police. "I'm here trying to change my life," he explained. "I've been to jail too many times." The company that lost the money plans to give him a $5,000 reward. Our controversy of the week: Obama's foreign policy. Is caution weakness or wisdom? It was billed as President Obama's comeback speech on foreign policy, said Niall Gardner in TheHill.com. Instead, in a commencement address last week at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, the president delivered a highly defensive series of excuses for why U.S. global leadership is in decline, confirming his reputation as a lackluster commander-in-chief with an empty foreign policy vision. Despite an obligatory sprinkling of rah-rah platitudes, America must always lead on the world stage. If we don't, no one else will. Obama came across as the anti-Reagan, making a mushy appeal for caution, passivity, and multilateralism in dealing with the world's bad actors. The speech was coolly received, said Thomas Lifson in AmericanThinker.com, both by the cadets, whose sparse applause sounded icy, and even by the New York Times editorial page, which called it uninspiring and said it lacked strategic sweep. "What silly knee-jerk criticism," said Fareeh Zakaria in WashingtonPost.com. Conservative hawks seem stuck in the antiquated belief that the only kind of international leadership that means anything is the use of military force. In the 21st century, the U.S. has no enemy on the scale of Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany, and the conflicts are smaller and messier. In Syria, Libya, and other hot spots, the U.S.'s best interests are not readily apparent. Obama has used military force ferociously to attack al-Qaeda in several countries, but knows that sending our troops into regional conflicts is less effective and more dangerous than diplomacy and coalition building. "Have the neocons no shame?" said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. Having presided over the Iraq debacle and the longest war in U.S. history, in Afghanistan, they now call Obama feckless because he doesn't share their delusion that the U.S. can simply impose its will on an unruly world. With their two botched wars, their embrace of torture, and their disdain for an international law, George W. Bush and his neocon buddies did more damage to America's global standing than our supposedly feckless president. "Obama's defenders are giving us a false choice," said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. They argue that the only alternative to the president's passivity is full-scale military invasions. Not so. And the Obama doctrine, if there is one, has not produced very impressive results. Having pulled out of Iraq, Obama now watches it descend back into civil war. The Russian reset backfired disastrously. His red line on chemical weapons use in Syria was crossed and recrossed like center ice in an exciting hockey game. There certainly is an Obama doctrine, said Charles Krautheimer in WashingtonPost.com. His is the foreign policy of retreat, and one can only marvel at the smallness of it. Have you noticed what happened in Ukraine, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. After annexing Crimea and threatening eastern Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin felt the sting of international sanctions and pressure and backed down, letting Ukrainians elect a new leader. As Obama said in his speech, Russia was contained because of American leadership and without us firing a shot. The mystery to me, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune, is why more conservatives aren't applauding Obama's approach. They're usually rightly skeptical of government's ability to solve complex problems and wary of unintended consequences. Few things are more costly and harmful to American interest than an unnecessary, unsuccessful war. And a foreign policy designed to keep us out of such wars could properly be called conservative. And it was a good week for romance. After a 113-year-old woman married her 70-year-old boy toy in a ceremony at their Chinese nursing home. She takes good care of me and gives me her portion of meat during meals, Amti Ahemti said of his new wife, Azathan Sawuti. It was a good week for answering God's call after a French Catholic priest began offering blessings for his parishioners' smartphones in a bid to attract more people to his church. The blessing of a communication device is written into the tradition of the church, said Father Frederick Lequin, just like with boats, carts, and all instruments of labor. It was a good week for brilliance when, for the first time in 52 years, the Scripps National Spelling Bee crowned two winners, Ansun Sujo, 13, and Sriram Hathwar, 14, after they exhausted the championship word list. It was a bad week for judicial activism after a Florida judge, irked by persistent public defender's legal arguments, challenged him to a fistfight. Let's go out back and I'll just beat your ass, said Judge John Murphy, who allegedly scuffled with the lawyer before police intervened. It was a bad week for following your passion after an Englishman was sentenced to 5 years in jail for threatening to kill a family when they asked him to stop using their farm to indulge in his bizarre sexual fetish, rolling around naked in cow dung. And it was a bad week for lawnmowers after a Kansas City, Missouri woman grew so tired of tending her lawn that she decided to get rid of the grass by covering it with 80 tons of sand. Now being over 60, said Georgiana Reed, I've decided I wasn't going to mow any more or water. Over on the briefing page, the cloud over the World Cup. The planet's biggest sporting event kicks off next week amid grave doubts about Brazil's ability to play host. Is Brazil ready for the Cup? Yes, but just barely. All 12 stadiums built or rebuilt for the Cup have been approved for game play, but half missed completion deadlines and several are still short on seats and other amenities. In Natal, where the U.S. plays Ghana in its June 16 tournament opener, workers have hung colorful canvas tarps depicting beach scenes over unfinished access ramps. Getting to the games could be a huge challenge, as many major transportation projects, including a promised high-speed rail between Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, have been delayed or abandoned. Labor strife, corruption, and construction accidents. 8 workers died while building World Cup stadiums have driven the cost of hosting the event from an original estimate of less than $1 billion to more than $11.5 billion. From start to finish, the frantic effort to prepare for the Cup has laid bare deep economic and social ills that have plagued Brazil for decades. The fiascos are multiplying, said Gil Castelo Branco of the Brazilian economic watchdog group Contas Abertas. Immense resources have been wasted on extravagant projects when our public schools are still a mess and raw sewage is still in our streets. Why was Brazil awarded the tournament? When the bid was granted in 2007, Brazil was in the midst of an economic boom. Delegates from FIFA, soccer's international governing body, reported being greeted with spontaneous manifestations of joy and hope while visiting prospective sites in Brazil. And polls showed that 78% of Brazilians supported hosting the tournament. International investors were lining up to tap the emerging market that boasted 30 million consumers who were climbing from poverty into the middle class. Brazil was also a sentimental choice. Soccer, or O Jogo Bonito, the beautiful game, is the very lifeblood of Brazilian culture, and the country has won 5 cups, more than any other. Hosting the World Cup was meant to be a coming-out party for the world's 7th largest economy, a celebration of Brazil's prosperity and growing cultural import. Football is more than a sport for us, then-President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said at the time. It's a national passion. So what went wrong? Nearly everything. Poor planning, corruption, and bureaucratic meddling turned the construction projects into a disaster, with massive overspending and blown deadlines. Forced relocations of an estimated 250,000 residents and controversial pacification efforts in Brazil's thousands of slums, or favelas, angered the population. Things came to a head last year during the FIFA Confederations Cup, an 8-nation tournament that serves as a World Cup dress rehearsal. Some 1 million demonstrators took to the streets in several cities, decrying the sorry state of education, sanitation, and transportation in Brazil, and demanding FIFA-standard hospitals, roads, and schools. Some hardcore activists attacked government buildings and banks. As a member of one such group, Los Vanda told Financial Times, "The World Cup attends to the economic interest of FIFA and not the interests of society." How did the authorities respond? Harshly. Police fired tear gas at protesters, and a TV cameraman was killed in a clash between protesters and police at Rio's main train station in February. In an effort to control crowds at the Cup, authorities are deploying nearly 160,000 paramilitary troops during the month-long tournament. They've also purchased some 270,000 stun grenades and tear gas canisters. Police pacification units have taken control of dozens of favelas that have long been dominated by violent drug gangs. But order has come at a price. 1,890 people were killed by police in 2012, according to official records, and less than 25% of citizens say the cops are trustworthy. Street crime has surged, prompting authorities to distribute pamphlets urging the 600,000 foreign World Cup visitors not to resist or cry for help during a mugging, to minimize the chance that they'll be murdered too. Despite the unrest, authorities insist that the games will be safe. I can assure you that Brazil has conducted a very well-planned operation to secure the 12 cities, said Army General Roberto Escoto. Will the games be disrupted? Once the tournament begins, says the Brazilian sports ministry, a festive mood will take over, and there will be no room for violent protest. Despite all the trouble, nearly all of the 3.3 million game tickets have been sold. Many Brazilians predict that the ultimate success or failure of this World Cup lies at the feet of Seleção, Brazil's national team. If it wins its matches, Brazilians will be ecstatic and pour into the streets in celebration. If it falls short, the unfairness and inefficiency that have marred the run-up to the Cup will come to define it. The World Cup will put Brazil in the middle of the planet's attention, said political writer Senara Menezes, for good or for bad. And we'll take a look at a few columns now from the U.S. This comes from Max Fisher at Vox.com. Snowden's Russian deception. On at least one important matter, Edward Snowden can't be telling the truth, said Max Fisher. Quote, I have no relationship with the Russian government, Snowden adamantly insisted in an NBC interview last week. I'm not supported by the Russian government. Who does he think he's kidding? Russia has given him asylum, an apartment in Moscow, and a full-time guard slash escort. He was given a job with a Russian internet company, though he speaks no Russian. His lawyer, Anatoly Kucherina, is a well-known Kremlin loyalist who helps oversee Russia's internal security service, the FSB. Local reporters say that Snowden is surrounded by FSB agents wherever he goes. And are we expected to believe that the Kremlin played no role in Snowden's infamous Russian TV appearance, in which he asked President Vladimir Putin a softball question about Russian spying? Clearly, there is some sort of relationship between Snowden and the Kremlin. That doesn't invalidate the significance of the NSA materials he released, but his pretense about his dependency on Putin's regime raises troubling questions about what else he may be finessing or obfuscating. And a column from Europe. This one comes from Ireland. A Loss of Influence in America by Colm Quinn at the Irish Times. The Irish are no longer America's closest kin, said Colm Quinn. Our leaders keep trekking to the U.S. to plead for special treatment for the 50,000 undocumented Irish immigrants in the U.S. The Americans are always lovely hosts, smiling and wearing green ties, but the ties that matter frayed long ago. The U.S. has changed enormously since the 1960s, when Irish Americans were a rising political force and the Democratic Party did their bidding. These days, there is no Irishman in the Oval Office, and on immigration, we will have to get in line like everyone else. In fact, for perhaps the first time, Irish Americans didn't even vote for this Democratic president. The white Catholic vote, the best indicator of Irish American voting, went to the Republicans for the last three election cycles. With more important constituencies to appeal to, President Obama has no compelling reason to listen to Ireland, which is why the post of U.S. Ambassador to Dublin has been vacant since 2012. Ireland will have to give up on diaspora politics and focus instead on what it can get for its exports in upcoming trade talks between the U.S. and the European Union. Welcome to the era of reduced diplomatic clout. And our international column, How They See Us, Prisoner Swap Bypassed Afghans. The U.S. acts as if Afghanistan doesn't even have a government, said Huwad in an editorial. Five senior Taliban commanders were released from Guantanamo prison camp last week in exchange for U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who had been held by the militant group and its allies for 5 years. The Afghan government wasn't even informed of the prisoner swap, which was mediated by Qatar, until it was done. This behavior rakes up unpleasant memories of the 1980s when the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan. Peace talks back then took place in Geneva between the Soviets, the U.S., and some other governments, but no Afghan officials or Mujahideen were involved. Of course, the High Peace Council of Afghanistan has welcomed the exchange as a step toward confidence building, because what else could it say? The truth is, Afghans should have been consulted. Qatar has agreed to take temporary custody of the militants, but there's no guarantee the five won't return here to fight alongside the Taliban as soon as their one-year travel ban expires. This is dangerous and unwelcome news, said Arman A. Meli from Afghanistan. The Americans could have at least waited until the second round of Afghanistan's presidential election was over. Releasing five senior terrorists just 2 weeks before the runoff is destabilizing in the extreme. Obviously, the U.S. doesn't consider the Taliban to be terrorists anymore, said Hasht Essa. Why else would it allow the militants to open an office in Qatar and talk to them directly? This approach tells the Taliban that there is no need for them to hold talks with Kabul, and that they can win America's heart and achieve everything else they desire. We should still welcome the swap to a point, said Sarnavesh Daly. After all, five Afghans have been released from a dark and terrifying U.S. jail. These men were ripped from their families and endured cruelty, brutality, and tortures. Nobody deserves such a fate. Yet their release doesn't further our country's quest for peace one iota. Because of their psychological damage, as well as their ignorance of how the Taliban have changed over the 12 years of their incarceration, these men can't assist in the peace process. In fact, the prospects for peace just got worse, said the Daily Times. NATO is leaving soon, and the Taliban now have no incentive to negotiate with Afghan authorities. Once the foreign troops are gone, the Taliban will attack in force, and intra-Afghan and intra-Pashtun civil war will commence. Don't expect the peace process to restart until the two sides once again reach a bloody stalemate. We'll turn now to the last word. The title of our in-depth article this week is Trapped Between Life and Death. People in a vegetative state seem unresponsive, said Roger Highfield, but we can now communicate with them. Imagine you wake up locked inside a box, said Adrian Owen, a neurologist at the University of Western Ontario. It's only just big enough to hold your body, but sufficiently small that you can't move. It's a perfect fit, down to every last one of your fingers and toes. It's a strange box because you can listen to absolute everything going on around you, yet your voice cannot be heard. In fact, the box fits so tightly around your face and lips that you can't speak or make a noise. Although you can see everything going on around the box, the world outside is oblivious to what's going on inside. Inside, there's plenty of time to think. At first, this feels like a game, even one that's strangely amusing. Then, reality sets in. You're trapped. You see and hear your family lamenting your fate. Over the years, the couriers forgot to turn on the TV. You're too cold. Then you're too hot. Then always thirsty. The visits of your friends and family dwindle. Your partner moves on, and there's nothing you can do about it. Owen becomes animated, describing the torment of those with no voice, his patients. People in a vegetative state are awake, yet unaware. Their eyes can open and sometimes wander. They can smile, grasp another's hand, cry, groan, or grunt. but they are unable to see or understand speech. Their motions are not purposeful but reflexive. They appear to have shed their memories, emotions, and intentions, those qualities that make each one of us an individual. Their minds remain firmly shut. Still, when their eyelids flutter open, you are always left wondering if there's a glimmer of consciousness. A decade ago, the answer would have been a bleak and emphatic no. Not any longer. Using brain scanners, Owen has found that some may be trapped inside their bodies, yet able to think and feel to varying extents. The number of patients with disorders of consciousness has soared in recent decades, ironically, because of the rise and success of intensive care and medical technologies. Doctors have steadily got better at saving patients with catastrophic injuries, though it remains much easier to restart a heart than restore a brain. Today, trapped, damaged, and diminished minds inhabit clinics and nursing homes worldwide. In Europe alone, the number of new coma cases is estimated to be around 230,000 annually, of which some 30,000 will languish in a persistent vegetative state. They are some of the most tragic and expensive artifacts of modern intensive care. Owen knows this only too well. In 1997, a close friend set off on her usual cycle to work. She had a weak spot on a blood vessel in her head, known as a brain aneurysm. 5 minutes into her trip, the aneurysm burst, and she crashed into a tree. She never regained consciousness. The tragedy left Owen numb, yet his friend's accident would shape the rest of his life. He began to wonder if there was a way to determine which of these patients were in an unconscious coma, which were conscious, and which were somewhere in between. That year, he had moved to Cambridge University, where researchers used various scanning techniques. One, positron emission tomography, PET, highlights different metabolic processes in the brain, such as oxygen and sugar use. Another, known as functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, can reveal active centers in the brain by detecting the tiny surges in blood flow that take place as a mind whirs. Owen wondered whether he could use these technologies to reach out to patients, like his friend, stuck between sensibility and oblivion. At the core was a deceptively simple question. How do we know that another person is conscious? What do we mean by dead? And who should declare when an individual is dead? A priest? A lawyer? A doctor? A machine? Owen discussed these issues at a symposium in Brazil with the Dalai Lama and says he was surprised to find that they both agreed strongly on one point. We need to create an ethical framework for science that is based on secular rather than religious views. Science alone should define what we mean by death. The problem is that the scientific definition of death remains as unresolved as the definition of consciousness. Much confusion is sowed by the term clinical death, the cessation of blood circulation and breathing. Even though this is reversible, the term is often used by mind-body dualists who cling to the belief that a soul, or self, can persist separately from the body. Today, however, being alive is no longer linked to having a beating heart, explains Owen. If I have an artificial heart, am I dead? If you are on a life support machine, are you dead? Is a failure to sustain independent life a reasonable definition of death? No, otherwise we would all be dead in the 9 months before birth. The issue becomes murkier when we consider those trapped in the twilight worlds between normal life and death. From those who slip in and out of awareness, who are trapped in a minimally conscious state, to those who are severely impaired in a vegetative state or coma. These patients first appeared in the wake of the development of the artificial respirator during the 1950s in Denmark, an invention that redefined the end-of-life terms of the idea of brain death and created the specialty of intensive care. In 2006, Owen was trying to find a reliable way to communicate with patients in a vegetative state, including Jillian, not her real name. In July 2005, this 23-year-old had been crossing a road, chatting on her mobile phone. She was struck by two cars. Yet though she had been diagnosed as vegetative, there was something about her that caught the attention of her doctor, who submitted her for study, by Owen. 5 months later, a strange stroke of serendipity allowed Jillian to unlock her box. The key arose from a study Owen started with Stephen Lawries in 2005. They had asked healthy volunteers to imagine doing different things, such as singing songs or conjuring up the face of their mother. Then Owen had another idea. "I just had a hunch," he says. "I asked a healthy control to imagine playing tennis. Then I asked her to imagine walking through the rooms of her house. Imagining tennis activates part of the cortex, called the supplementary motor area, involved in the mental simulation of movements. But imagining walking around the house activates the parahippocampus gyrus in the core of the brain, the posterior parietal lobe, and the lateral premotor cortex. The two patterns of activity were as distinct as a yes and a no. So if people were asked to imagine tennis for yes and walking around the house for no, they could answer questions via fMRI. Gazing into Jillian's vegetative brain with the brain scanner, Owen asked her to imagine the same things and saw strikingly similar activation patterns to the healthy volunteers. It was an electric moment. Owen could read her mind. Jillian's case, published in the Journal of Science in 2006, made front page headlines around the world. The result provoked wonder and, of course, disbelief. "Broadly speaking, I received two types of emails from my peers," said Owen. "They either said, 'This is amazing, well done,' or 'How could you possibly say this woman is conscious?'" As the old saw goes, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. The skeptics countered that it was wrong to make these radical inferences when there could be a more straightforward interpretation. Daniel Greenberg, a psychologist at the University of California, Los Angeles, suggested that the brain activity was unconsciously triggered by the last word of the instructions, which always referred to the item to be imagined. Since Owen's 2006 science paper, studies in Belgium, the UK, the US, and Canada suggest that a significant proportion of the patients who were classified as vegetative in recent years have been misdiagnosed. Owen estimates perhaps as many as 20%. Nicholas Schiff, a neurologist who weighs up to the extent of misdiagnosis a different way, goes further. Based on recent studies, he says around 40% of patients thought to be vegetative are, when examined more closely, partly aware. In 2009, Lawry's team asked one of the original group of 54 patients that he and Owen had studied, patient 23, a series of yes or no questions. It was the usual drill. Imagine playing tennis for yes, navigating the house for no. The patient, who had been in a vegetative state for 5 years, was able to answer 5 of 6 questions about his earlier life, and all of those were correct. He had been on holiday to a certain place prior to his injury. Was such and such his father's name? "It was an exciting moment," said Lawries. "We were stunned," adds Owen, who helped independently score the test. By showing us that he was conscious and aware, patient 23 moved himself from "do not resuscitate" category to the "not allowed to die" category. Did we save his life? No, he saved his own life. this is your big chance. Just do your best. Owen gazed down at 39-year-old Scott Routley lying on a gurney. Scott had studied physics at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, but his promising career in robotics came to an end when, aged 26, he collided with a police vehicle. Since that accident in 1999, Scott had been diagnosed as being in a vegetative state by a well-seasoned neurologist, Brian Young, and in 2012 his diagnosis was confirmed by Owen's team, again using traditional methods. As Owen talked to him, Scott's mouth remained wide open, the same way that he'd been in the 12 years since the accident. This encounter was filmed by a crew from the BBC. A reporter was there to witness the moment that Owen attempted to reach inside Scott's mind. Owen admits now that he was skeptical that the scans would reveal anything at all. The team scanned Scott several times. To their surprise, the pattern of brain activity showed that Scott knew exactly who he was, where he was, and that he was actively choosing to answer the team's questions. My heart stopped when we asked it, after 12 years. Scott was in pain, Owen recalls. Thankfully, the answer was no. The BBC crew was surprised at the family's relative lack of celebration. Not Owen. Scott's family had always been convinced that he was conscious. Perhaps the family discerned subtle signs of consciousness that were almost undetectable, even to the trained eye. Or perhaps they had deceived themselves, as many families do, for comfort. Either way, it was the word of the family against that of my team, and their word against an army of specialists over many years, said Owen. Where the family saw a sign of cognition, the doctors saw only wishful thinking. The scan showed that they were right. Perhaps for the wrong reasons, we will never know. But Scott's story teaches us the value of objective measures and the need for a little humility. This was adapted from a longer article that originally appeared at mosaicscience.com. We'll take one of the obituaries in this week. The inspirational writer who chronicled the Black experience. Maya Angelou, 1928 to 2014. Maya Angelou was relentlessly creative. In her 86 years, she was an actress, a singer, a dancer, a journalist, and a film director, as well as an essayist and a Pulitzer Prize-nominated poet. But Angelou's crowning achievement was her 1969 memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which turned a childhood of oppression and abuse in the segregated South into a hymn to the power of human endurance. There isn't enough written for black girls in America that says, listen, you might encounter defeats, but you must never be defeated, she said of the book. One would say of my life, born loser, had to be. From a broken family, raped at 8, unwed mother at 16, I wanted to show it's a face, but it's not the truth. Angela was born Marguerite Ann Johnson in St. Louis and became Maya because her brother, Bailey, found it difficult to pronounce her name, said the Times. When she was 3, her parents split, and Angelou and Bailey went to live with their grandmother in Stamps, Arkansas, a town so segregated, she wrote, that most black children didn't really absolutely know what whites looked like. During a visit to St. Louis, Angelou was raped by her mother's boyfriend and later testified against him in court. He was found guilty, but was murdered before he could be sentenced. Most likely, Angelou said, by her uncles. She was so shocked that she spoke to no one but her brother for 5 years. I thought my voice had killed him, she said, so it was better not to speak. It was through literature that Angelou regained her voice. She heard poetry for the first time when her teacher read aloud from Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, said the Los Angeles Times, and soon began to memorize and recite works by William Shakespeare and Langston Hughes. After middle school, Angelou moved to California, where at 16, a clumsy sexual encounter left her pregnant. Raising her son alone, Angelou worked any job she could find, from streetcar conductor to brothel madam, before marrying an aspiring Greek-American musician, Tosh Angelou, in 1951. When the couple divorced several years later, she embarked on a career as a calypso dancer and singer under the name Maya Angelou, a variant of her married name, said the New York Times. In the early 1960s, she fell in love with South African freedom fighter Vizumsi Make and moved with him to Egypt, where she became a journalist at an English language magazine, before heading to Ghana to work as an editor. She returned to the U.S. in 1964 to join Malcolm X's civil rights campaign, but he was assassinated before she could begin that work. Her writing career took off in the late 1960s, when a dinner companion, captivated by Angelou's childhood stories, urged Random House editor Robert Loomis to commission an autobiography from her, said the Wall Street Journal. The result was I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, an immediate bestseller. That book was followed by a torrent of creative output in every possible medium, said Time.com. She appeared on Broadway, directed a movie, 1998's Down in the Delta, and published six more volumes of autobiography, several children's books, and more than a dozen poetry collections. Critics said her poetry was little more than prose with line breaks, a view that wasn't changed when she read her celebration of American diversity on the Pulse of Mourning at President Clinton's 1993 inauguration. But that criticism didn't bother Angelou's millions of readers who continued to cherish her wisdom. Be certain that you do not die without having done something wonderful for humanity, she wrote in 2008's Letter to My Daughter. For her admirers, said the Independent, Angelou herself more than achieved that. On the Health and Science page, The Trade That Made Us Human. The human brain consumes 20% of our energy each day, and new research suggests that its voraciousness may be the result of an evolutionary trade-off. Our ancestors developed smarts at the expense of strength. The findings are based on a study of metabolism, the way the body converts food and energy in humans, chimps, mice, and rhesus monkeys. Specifically, scientists looked at the metabolic profile for kidney, thigh muscle, and three brain regions in each species. They then calculated how rapidly these metabolisms changed relative to each other, starting from when the species diverged and began evolving on different tracks. It turned out that over 6 million years, the prefrontal cortex changed 4 times faster in humans than in chimps, and muscle changed 8 times faster, with more brain power developing at the expense of our muscular strength. Pound for pound, humans today are about half as strong as monkeys and chimps, biologist Roland Roberts tells NationalGeographic.com. But we're significantly smarter. Weak muscles may be the price we pay for the metabolic demands of our amazing cognitive powers, Roberts said. The collective genius of ants. Ants are better than Google at processing data. That's the conclusion of a new mathematical study that looked at how ants transform what begins as a seemingly random search for food into a highly organized network. Researchers used computer modeling to translate well-known ant behavior patterns into equations and algorithms. They discovered that insects divide themselves into two groups, scouts and gatherers. Scouts that are successful in finding food will take a scrap back to the nest, dropping a trail of pheromones along the way to mark the path. Subsequent waves of ants will follow the trail, which becomes refined as more ants traverse it, leaving even more pheromone markers until the best, shortest route between food and nest is found. I'd go so far as to say that the learning strategy involved in that is more accurate and complex than a Google search. Professor Jürgen Kurz of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research tells The Independent, researchers also found that the scouts tend to be older ants, which have greater experience exploring the nest surroundings. The younger ants do the grunt work of gathering. And on the talking points page, shooting rampage. Does culture create killers? If Columbine taught us about school bullying in the 1990s, said Jessica Bennett in Time.com, then the lesson of Elliot Rodgers' shooting rampage is the toxic way that failed sex, misogyny, and modern masculinity are intertwined in America today. All you girls who rejected me and looked down upon me, I hate you, Roger, 22, said in the rage-filled video he posted on YouTube. I can't wait to give you exactly what you deserve, utter annihilation. Acting out a cultural fantasy in which a humiliated man reclaims lost manhood through spectacular violence, Roger then stabbed his two male roommates and a friend to death, shot 16 people, killing three, near the campus of the University of California, Santa Barbara, and would have killed scores more had he not been denied entry to a sorority house with three handguns and more than 400 rounds of ammunition. Roger's actions were extreme, said Jessica Valenti in TheGuardian.com, but the sexist ideas behind them are deeply woven into American masculine culture, the over-the-top sexual entitlement, and the neat division of women into sluts who have sex and bitches who say no. Every day, women in this country must contend with leering stares, butt grabs, and sickening levels of domestic violence. If Roger's rampage doesn't do it, what will it take for Americans to get real about how profoundly misogynist our country really is? These females are apparently living in a different world than mine, said Heather McDonald in NationalReview.com. Roger was clearly a narcissistic madman, not a typical male leading a war on women. And where is this world full of leering, grasping men? Today, only sickos on the edges of society grope women on trains or buses. If feminists really want to see sexual violence, they should go to Afghanistan, India, or Nigeria. Meanwhile, when it comes to America's problem with mass slaughter, the best hope for ending violence against women and men, who continue to make up 77% of all U.S. murder victims, is by treating mental illness, not railing against the imaginary patriarchy. Misogyny is hardly imaginary, said Amanda Hess in Slate.com. After Roger's killing spree, millions of women took to Twitter and the Internet to share their own experiences of being harassed and threatened with violence by men. Men don't often realize how bad it is because the creeps usually are careful to harass women when nobody is looking. A week before the murders, I was stretching outside a store after a run in Palm Springs, California, when a man sitting at a nearby bus stop started yelling obscene comments about my body. When my boyfriend came out of the convenience store, he shut up. Hollywood doesn't help, said Anne Hornaday in WashingtonPost.com. Roger, the son of a director, grew up in a world that sells female objectification and sexual wish fulfillment, and he couldn't believe buxom blondes weren't throwing themselves at him. How many men raised on a diet of Judd Apatow comedies in which the schlubby arrested adolescent always gets the girl find that those happy endings constantly elude them and conclude, it's not fair. Still, that doesn't mean we should let mass killers hold the culture hostage, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. If the Batman movie somehow contributed to the Aurora, Colorado massacre, video games played some role in Sandy Hook, and frat boy fantasies polluted Roger's sick mind, then what exactly do people propose? Should we police film, politics, novels, video games, and every other type of communication, just in case they set off a statistically microscopic minority of crazy people? There's a deeper cultural problem, said Mark Morford in sfgate.com. It's the guns. Deeply embedded in the American psyche is a fetishized worship of firearms, the icons of bogus virility. In the 70-plus mass killings over the last three decades, every perpetrator has decided that the only way to prove he's a man, to get back at women, the boss, the world, is to buy a firearm and start shooting. Let Elliot Rogers spell it out. Who's the alpha male now, bitches? He wrote in his 140-page manifesto after he bought his first Glock semi-automatic pistol. Until American men realize that relying on a gun makes you less of a man and that authentic masculinity doesn't involve violence, we face even more unimaginable pain, and nearly all of it at the hands of men. And we'll close out today's reading with a quote from Maya Angelou, quoted in USA Today. Without courage, we cannot practice any other virtue with consistency. We can't be kind, true, merciful, generous, or honest. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.